The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. This week, I'm speaking with the founder of At Will Radio, Will Malnati.
I don't know, I'm all short here. I need that tight. There we go.
Just manhandle it.
Dude, did I tell you about how that phrase has, like, scarred me forever?
Manhandle?
Yeah. When Chris and I were moving to New York from Charleston.
You got manhandled?
Verbally, yeah.
Is that good?
That's fine for me. I had to get, except I always go sideways like this. I had to go to Home Depot to get like the hitch to tow our car behind the truck. And I don't know how to do any of that stuff. Like, I have no idea. Like, anything having to do with like manual labor or automotive stuff, I have no idea. So I'm like asking people, well, how do I hook the car up onto the trailer and the hitch? And they're like, oh, it's real easy. And I'm like, be that as it may, can someone show me? And so like this 16-year-old girl in, you know, in like Carhartt overalls takes me out there.
I was like, get out of the way.
And the whole time I'm just like, this is so emasculating. But so she leans down over the hitch between the trailer and the moving truck, and she's turning this crank. And ad nauseum, she's repeating, you just got to manhandle it. You just got to manhandle it. And I, oh my gosh. And I knew immediately I would not be able to equal this 16-year-old girl in strength or manhandling.
That's awesome. Did you guys take a picture together?
Is it awesome? I'm not so sure. We did not capture the moment via photography.
Just something for you to, like, you know, live up to.
Something to remember her by.
Yeah. It's so funny because then I watched, you know, Game of Thrones, and actually my favorite character, I just finished season 6 finally, but my favorite character is the young queen of the...
The dragon queen or whatever?
No, the young little one.
Dude, I don't watch Game of Thrones. Come on, bro.
Okay. Dude.
But she inspires you, this young queen.
She's 12, and she's like, you, like, come over here.
Wait, is she
you're the
is,
one?
Is she the daughter of like the Cersei or whatever? So like his daughter?
No.
Okay, that, those are the only two characters
younger
I know.
Too.
I guess the
yeah,
two characters.
This one has come in like in the last. We have to delete all of this.
No, this is
this is staying. This
that's
is good.
That's so odd to me that you get into that.
Really?
It seems a little bit to run against your normal inhalation of media.
I totally agree with you, and I see it. And trust me, I held off for, 5 to 6 years that it's been on? I just started. And I think what it's become is this natural routine that my girlfriend and I have that's like, are we done with our day yet? Are we done with the madness? And if we are,
yeah, right.
We both look at each other and we're like, it's Game of Thrones time.
Really?
Let's turn it on. And that literally, and I don't know, whatever it is, it's just pretty easy. It's you know, it's not like a sitcom.
Well, but yeah, it's obviously a complete departure from reality.
Oh, yeah. You're way far away at that point.
Did you ever,
between
did,
11
did you ever,
and 12.
Did you ever watch The Night Of?
Yeah, of course. We did that too.
What'd you think of that?
I thought it was great. I thought that the characters were really interesting.
I thought that was so engrossing. It felt like such a textured and artistic, like, procedural crime show, but without just like the tidiness that, you know, every murderer is caught at the conclusion of every episode.
Who's your favorite character in it?
Oh, geez. I mean, I'm going to blank on the guy's name, but the guy that plays the victim's stepdad, he's a blonde-haired guy. He's like the trainer who, you know, they think is maybe trying to angle himself to get the townhouse. I loved him in another HBO show called Boardwalk Empire, and he played this really kind of squeaky-voiced patsy of a gangster that no one respected. And I loved seeing him in The Night Of, because it wasn't until like the third time I'd seen him that I even realized it was him. And so I think just seeing like kind of the spectrum across which he could invade and inhabit a character, I was really taken with him. And then, I mean, John Turturro.
I think you're the only one who has said that. Not saying he wasn't a good performance. The fact that you pinpointed him, though, out of these amazing characters.
Well, I mean, John Turturro was just like, he was so great. I mean, in the dynamic, not only with the eczema on his feet, but even like when he gets the cat and like the whole interplay between him and the cat, I just found so like revealing about who he was. Like, and for me, that's probably what I loved most about that show was I thought in subtle ways they told us as an audience who those people were without hammering us, you know, with an axe or whatever. And I think that's hard to do. And so I was really taken with that. But I tried Game of Thrones and I got, man, two or three episodes in, which probably isn't a fair shake. And then I left for work for like 2 weeks. And by the time I'd gotten back, Kristen had like plowed through like two seasons. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to like you've left me behind, you know, like you've left me behind. And so I never engaged it again.
And it's like, you can't ask her for a recap at that point.
No, because as soon as someone starts saying, well, when the dragon comes, you just start snickering and you
Yeah, exactly.
Like that's one of those shows that you have to see it because if anyone tries to explain it to you, you kind of think, I'm not sure I want to be like you.
Right. I'm not into that type of thing. Well, that's why I held off for so long. I was like, come on. I don't like that type of thing. I don't like sci-fi. I don't like, you know, I don't really like the non-realistic kind of version of things.
Yeah,
and so when I finally got into it, it took me a while and I became a little bit more accepting. And still, I'm like, ah.
Right.
It's still a dragon.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not all real, but the parts that are real are unbelievable.
Yeah.
But let me ask you a question about the night of. You as an author, do you take something like this eczema-ridden lead character, do you put the metaphorical story behind it? What is the eczema? The night of has this character, the lead character, who has a terrible case of eczema, and he is this attorney who is there to help save the day of this other character who may or may not have been wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
And so throughout the episodes, it keeps kind of going to this issue of him trying to deal with his eczema and fix his eczema and.
Mm-hmm.
What is it symbolically?
Yeah, like what's behind that? I mean, I don't know. I try not to when I see something like that, I tend to try to take it at face value, at first at least, and assume that they're just allowing it to be an actual condition of this person and not always some metaphor for something else. But to me, I guess watching that, one of the things I loved about him is that it constantly – to me, reminded me of why he would be insecure in his own role, and not just as a human being, but as someone who needs to be respected in a court of law, as someone who has to stand before, in a civic sense, some of the most kind of honorable people we have, like judges and police officers, or in a moment, juries. I mean, in the moment when an ordinary citizen kind of becomes, you know, the proverbial executioner or god of someone's fate, the fact that he has to stand before him not only and convey confidence but have any sort of like dignity in his own right. I loved kind of the paradox and the tension that not only that created for me as a viewer but that I knew inherently created in him. I mean, I thought back to, you know, when I've had, acne or bad haircuts and how horrific you feel and to think he's got to like trot himself out into these really formal environments all the time having that, I just thought that created such a unique dynamic like throughout the entire show. Well, and predominantly, though not always, predominantly had it on his feet. And I thought that was such a unique way to do it because it's almost like not at everyone's eye level, but it's there all the time. And obviously because he's in a courtroom and dressed formally all the time, it's like from the shins up, you don't notice it. But then you see for him in order to kind of soothe the pain of this condition, he wraps his feet in like saran wrap or whatever it is, and then he wears sandals like at the bottom of this suit. And so it was like it was always there, even when they weren't talking about it, or even when it wasn't front and center. It was always there. I really thought, I don't know, but that's the kind of stuff I gravitate towards. Like, I mean, I can get down with a dragon show, you know, just like everybody. And one of my favorite childhood movies is The Neverending Story. But on the whole, I suppose maybe a little more like you, I tend to feel a little more of a connection and affinity to stuff that feels like it's plausible in the context of my own life right now. Like something could happen on my way back from the studio to my apartment whereby I might need to call on an attorney who could show up and he would have eczema and then my life might kind of unfold in a similar fashion. I tend to like that.
Right.
Do you remember the first movie or first work of art? And I use that in the broadest sense. Movie, television, music that you really kind of felt impacted by?
Yeah, I think when you ask a question like that, my mind immediately goes to a couple films because I think, you know, when I was growing up, we would have – I remember at our place we had 15 VHSs, and at my grandmother's house where we spent every holiday, there was – she had another 20 or, you know. So between those 35 VHSs – I had seen them all, you know, 20 times each.
Right.
And so the things that stick out, those first kind of movies, were The Sandlot, I guess.
Oh,
that was, you know, I remember I used to love baseball movies. A Rookie of the Year was one.
Yeah.
And I think that ultimately, you know, when I look back to these movies, you know, and then my dad introduced me to, you know, Animal House at a younger age than he should have. And it was all just kind of looking up to these characters kind of and in an aspirational way. You know, I wanted to be the best baseball player or, you know, be the life of the party or something like that. And I think so it was always kind of those types of movies when I was growing up is like, if I watch this movie enough, maybe I'll become, you know, like more like these characters that are doing such amazing things.
Right, right.
Crushing beer cans on their head.
Yeah, wearing togas, smashing guitars.
Yeah. And then I remember I listened to Michael Jackson Dangerous album probably, I don't know, 3,000 times.
Yeah.
And I knew every word, and that's a big, like, part of my childhood in a way.
What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I knew I was active, and I loved the, you know, being in front of people, and I loved making people laugh, and I loved, you know, there's this funny story that my parents will tell of me when I was growing up. I went to multiple, not just one, weddings, you know, of my parents' friends or whatever. And I had a, you know, a suit or like some version of like a tuxedo. I even was in a, like my aunt's wedding or something. And I would always wear the Superman outfit under it because at any moment, you see where I'm going with this. At any moment, I would have to find the nearest, you know, closet.
Phone booth.
In that case, a closet.
Right.
to you know, change out of Clark Kent and into Superman. And that at these events, you know, if you looked closely at my outfit, you could see the red collar showing through or the, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Or down through my ankles. Yeah.
So you knew, or at least you connected as a kid with the idea of doing something significant.
Yeah, I think of doing something in that kind of performing arts realm.
Yeah.
And so I followed it pretty quickly.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
That's where my mind was at. How could I be in front of people? You know, there's a story also when I was, you know, growing up, my parents at a young age took us, me and my sisters, on a safari in Africa because they had friends that, you know, had had the place figured out kind of in Kenya and Tanzania. And so it was an amazing thing to like be able to do at such a young age. But there's, the, you know, there's photos. I don't think there was video of this, but of me like singing for this, you know, the Maasai tribe, which was, you know, the tribe in Kenya, and you know, the kids there who, you know, didn't speak English, but they would watch me perform, and then they'd give me like the like beaded, you know, necklaces or something. So it was like this trade-off, but I knew that I was offering something up, you know, what I mean, to them, and I loved kind of that, the feeling that it gave me.
And you, when you pursued that, because there you have a stint in your background where you, I don't know, you leveraged a lot of your time and energy towards acting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I've mentioned it in like my podcast before, but other than that, I mean, I don't really talk about it that much anymore. It was kind of like that chapter kind of, you know, that chapter ended. And yeah, I, for my grade school and into high school and a little bit in college, I was very much still pursuing, you know, acting and performing and music. And I was, you know, I know like during the summer I'd be like practicing with my band during the day. And then, you know, later on I'd have a audition for a whatever, a movie or a TV show or a commercial or something. And then, you know, and then later that night I'd be performing somewhere for someone, you know. And that was just kind of, those were the parts of my life that excited me. And so, yeah, I think like anything, your passions can evolve and change. And so that is pretty much what happened. But I still have the kind of, I like, you know, having the charisma and the ability to perform, just not necessarily on stage or
how would you describe your passions now? Because, I mean, I remember talking to I don't remember if it was my wife or a friend, and somebody asked me, they were like, well, what does Will do? And I kind of sat there for a moment, and I don't know if I leaned back or forward in my chair, but I eventually went, I don't really know. And I could explain some of the nuts and bolts, and, you know, we can talk about that too, and there's value in that. But if you were to remove the titles from what you do and describe what you're passionate about now, like what would you say?
I think that it's really become about connecting with people in all different forms and scenarios. And I think that the things that I learned as an actor and the passion that I have for being creative allows me to, and also, you know, don't forget that like my mom, you know, and my dad are just very loving people, and I think they brought me up to be a nice person as well, you know, and so I think the combination of those three things, if I had to define the one thing that I do a lot and that comes pretty easily to me, it's connecting with people on a deeper level than just kind of knowing them.
Yeah, right.
So I have the restaurant side, which, you know, I
Talk
been,
about that.
Yeah, I
That's
mean,
interesting
I
to
moved
me.
To New York 2007, and pretty much right after that, I started working in hospitality, and so I was, you know, managing restaurants and nightclubs and, you know, whatever I could be doing, and I think. That was great. I had grown up in the restaurant industry, so it was pretty natural to me. But again, the parts that I liked about that and the parts that I still like about that industry are less even, you know, oh, that I'm such a foodie or I'm obsessed with flavors, you know, and less that, oh, I want to make sure that every, you know, server is clocking in and out at the proper time that we've set in the procedure, and more of, in this environment, I'm able to facilitate conversation and human interaction And I do a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
not that I don't like it. Mm-hmm. I have to do it because by nature of the business. But I think that that's the one part that I've been able to like really lock into, and it's really served me well. And then yeah, so now I have At Will, and that's my baby right now. It allows me to not only connect with people personally, but have others like yourself and like the rest of our like amazingly talented hosts connect with others. And it allows me to be creative, and it allows me to sit back and think really far ahead and how cool would it be if we ...
yeah.
things. And that's the stuff that gets me up in the morning, you know? It's not necessarily the, how do I make sure that the servers are doing this or the managers are doing this or even that the editors are doing this. It's like, how do we create something bigger that's amazing, that involves connection between others?
Do you think that's hard to do today?
Do you think I just spoke for too long? Is the question that I had for you following that?
No.
I wasn't sure.
Do you think that's hard to do, to really connect with other people like today?
Well, it's just different. Connecting with people is different. It's not as, I guess, I don't know, organic or it's not as, not real, because I don't mean real. I guess it's just there's other ways that myself included, people choose to communicate and connect that is just a lot different than it used to be. And I'm the first person to say, like, I'm on my phone quite a bit, and it's not to be watching YouTube videos or to be, you know, using apps or even, I mean, a little bit of social media, but not even that much for me. It's more, it actually is upkeep of relationships. And so to answer your question, it's changed. I can upkeep a relationship a lot better this way because I don't have to always see someone to feel like I'm in someone's life.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not as genuine sometimes when it's being communicated. I mean, even just the other day, you know, one of my good friends said to me, hey, I hated how you wrote an email to me. It made me feel really bad. And for me, I had my reasons of why and how I wrote it. And it was, I wasn't trying to come off any certain way or the way that he felt like I had. It's just that's the nature of how we communicate these days more and more. And when I sit back and think, I'm like, wow, I did come off kind of like a dick. It wasn't my intention.
Sure.
But it's a lot of just one-sidedness and it's left for a lot of interpretation.
Do you take that, I mean, as someone who values as much as you do, not only connecting but really caring for the people you connect with, do you take it pretty hard when you receive an email or you have an encounter like the one you just mentioned?
When I get called out, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the other issue that I have, and I think we've talked about before and lots of people have, whether they know it or not, is just this idea of wanting people to like you and respect you and appreciate you. And so when someone calls you out on something, whether it was warranted or not, it's like, ooh, that hurts that you're telling me that I've done something wrong. Do you hate me?
Yeah, right.
Do you not like me now because of this? And so I could easily go there.
Yeah. Kristen and I, we've lived in New York for 2 years now. And
congratulations, you've survived.
Well, part of me, whatever remains of me has. But one of the things that I'm so unaccustomed to still, more than I was, but still not fully, that I have not fully acclimated into, is some of the ferocity with which people interact here, whether it's someone crossing the street or my landlord or whatever. And it was about a month ago where the door to our apartment, like out from the lobby onto the street, was open. And that makes me uncomfortable and I get scared. And so I went and I closed it. I'd come in, I was checking my mailbox, and I closed the door. As I do, the landlord rounds the bend on the sidewalk and comes trotting down the stairs, screaming at me. And I don't completely comprehend why, but I open the door for her and she yells at me and she says, I'm taking out all the trash. What do you think you're doing? And kind of goes off. And immediately, I feel myself internally cowering like a child, going, I'm a terrible person. I've done something awful. And then I kind of in my mind, you know, kind of play out this domino-centric scenario where now she's going to think all these terrible things about me, and now there's a chance I'm going to get evicted. And of course, after I get evicted, Kristen's going to leave. Like, it sounds absurd, no. But like I feel like the weight of criticism and the weight of a personal conflict so deeply, because I'm terrified that unless I play a perfect hand in a relationship every single time, whether it's with my landlord or whether it's with you or an acquaintance or one of my siblings, I'm terrified that the consequences of me upsetting them or hurting them are going to be permanent, and that I can't go back, and that I'm somehow going to see the dissolution of however many days, months, or years that relationship was built upon.
I mean, dude, I'm exactly the same. And I probably do it way more than I even could recall right now. But I feel for you on that, because, like, you know, even just like that email that I got saying, hey, I don't like when you talk to me like that in an email, it's then easy for me to start going down that road. So he hates me now.
Mm-hmm.
His girlfriend, who he's probably sitting next to right now and said, oh, Will's such a jerk. She hates me too.
Yep.
And then if those two people hate me, then I bet there's a handful of others I'm not even thinking of, but I could think of them really fast that hate me as well.
Yeah, right.
And slowly everyone hates me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my head. And then I, you know, can snap out of that by getting started on something else that will take my mind away from it.
I sometimes require days, though. Like, I can be in, like, a multiple-day funk. Like a moment like that, even if it seems completely innocuous to someone else. And I'm sure with my landlord, because the next time I saw her, which was maybe a week later, I mean, she was smiling and kind as if nothing had happened. But when I saw her approaching, I was like, oh my gosh, the elevator just closed behind me, you know? I feel trapped.
I couldn't see you, like, going into like any corner of any room and just staring at it.
Yes, I'm like that character in like the Blair Witch Project. I'm just like standing in the corner not wanting to look out. But I knew that moment was probably so innocuous to her and nothing. And she saw it nothing more than you closed the door and once I opened it, the moment was over. But for me, that moment, like, hovers. It like hovers and kind of haunts me. And then I kind of backtrack and strategize and move the chess pieces of that interaction around and go, what should I have done? How can I do it better next time so that someone else doesn't feel this way about me? And I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I'm sure there's like 10,000 things tangled up in that. But I think I long for the day when those moments start to dwindle, not just when I don't fear conflict, but when I don't feel like a relationship I have with someone is contingent on me behaving perfectly in it or appeasing that person all the time. Like, I guess maybe what I mean is I long for the day when I give myself margin for error.
Yeah.
What inspires you, Will? And I mean, we should say, like, Will is the CEO of At Will Radio. You know, he's been around the restaurant Toro here in New York City for, what, since 2007?
Later than that? Well, I've been around the city hospitality-wise, but Toro we opened in 2013.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So 3 years.
Okay. Plus. But I should say, I mean, all that being said, it's awesome to have you on the Merrill, man. I appreciate you doing this. You know, I've been pestering you to get in the box with me for a while.
No,
now.
You haven't been pestering me. You just slip like silent nods, like, huh. Who's a good restaurateur / I don't know, media?
Entrepreneur. Create, I feel like if we had someone whose name rhymed with Shmuel Malnati. Yeah.
But I just don't know anyone. Yeah. All right, see you later. And you walk out the door.
Yeah, see ya. But no, man, I'm so grateful you would do this.
Of course.
What inspires you? Like, I mean, for someone who has his hands in as much as you do, and not only professionally, but personally, and knowing like the reservoir of kindness and care and creativity out of which you live, I mean, that doesn't just not ever go dry. So what do you do to inspire you to keep pursuing all these things that you pursue?
Progress. I think progress inspires me a lot, and I guess what I mean by that is I could say success, but success doesn't – I think that implies that success happens like quickly or something. I think for me, I've been working on things that they take a long time to come to fruition. And then even after that, they take a long time to start seeing little pieces of success. And so for me, especially with what I'm all in on right now, which is this network, I'm inspired by the small wins.
Yeah. You know, you're familiar with the self-help guru, Tony Robbins?
I am.
You know? So I heard him say one time that happiness is progress.
Hold on. You have to do like an impression of him saying that, though.
Oh my gosh, that would be so be so embarrassing. I've tried to do impressions for my wife before.
Come on,
and she just doesn't even.
Come on,
he doesn't have a. I mean, I could do like another person impersonating him.
Okay, perfect. All right, let's do that.
All right, what do you want?
What you just said.
No, I know, but I mean, who am I impersonating? Because it's like I can't impersonate Harry Carey, but I can impersonate Will Ferrell impersonating
right.
Harry Carey.
Well, I don't know who impersonates him, but okay, say it me.
Okay, I'll impersonate Will Malnati saying or reciting a line from Tony Robbins. I'll be like, well, Josh, I mean.
Oh, God. Already? Is that how I sound?
I don't know. I can't.
Well, Josh.
I have like a simultaneous Will Malnati / old frontier prospector impersonation that I'm doing.
Yeah, he's like very like. I mean,
no, but I'm not impersonating him. I'm impersonating you. Impersonating him. He's deep though. I mean, he's a kind of a mountain of a man.
Yeah.
But regardless.
Okay, sorry.
No. He said happiness is progress, and I just never heard it talked about in those terms before. Like typically, people talk about either on the emotional end, or they talk about love, or they talk about something really ambiguous even. But just to hear him say happiness is progress. And I thought about that in the context of my own life, and I thought about it, in like a literary sense, like maybe a poetic piece I'm writing. And when you feel the progress of going, I know I'm getting closer to like the core of what I'm aiming for, whether that's linguistically or emotionally, there is a reward in that. But I think about it even in terms of like my relationships, like whether that's with my siblings, whether that's with a friend. When I look at maybe a scenario with Kristen, you know, that years ago would have derailed me or derailed us or thrown us into a marital funk. And then to see that scenario come around again and to see us navigate it better, I find such a reward in that. Or even on a character level, like the thing we're talking about before, when I feel like I prevent that spiral, that self-hatred spiral following what I perceive to be a negative interaction, and I see progress there. Like I do feel, a certain happiness or a certain fulfillment in that moment. It's like happiness knowing I'm continuing to evolve, getting closer to the guy I want to be, getting closer to the artist I want to be. And I mean, and to your point, and to Tony Robbins' point, I guess on the other side of that, when I tend to feel a real sense of despair is when I feel stuck, you know, not even just that I'm not growing, but like in my perception that I can't, that whether it's my circumstances or some fatal flaw in me, that I can't become a better writer, that I can't become a better friend, that some of the dysfunctions that haunt me are kind of permanently affixed to me, and that the lot I currently have is never going to change. Like, that's when I tend to feel despair. So the fact that you would define, you know, your sense of inspiration as progress, like, I don't know, that feels congruent with what I've experienced in my own personal life in all dimensions of my life. But you mentioned the word, I want to ask you about this too, because you mentioned the word success. And, you know, perception of you, just from my two eyes, is you have a bit of the Midas touch. Now, I know you, and so I know a little bit of some of the stories that have led to you being able to accomplish some of the things that you have. But how have you navigated failure in your life?
I think that for me, whenever you say the word failure to me these days, I swear only like one thing steps out in my mind, and that is not to say that I haven't failed a million times, because I have. But the one thing that stands out for me that I'm like, oh man, like that was a failure, or I was a failure because of, was, and I've talked about this a little, but like, you know, I had a restaurant that was successful or seemingly successful for a couple of years. And then in 2014, we had to close it. And, you know, that was so tough, only because I literally for, you know, those 2 years, I that was my life, you know, eat, sleep, and breathed that restaurant. And so to have something like that fail or not work the way that you wanted it to is like devastating. I mean, it's like the loss of a very close loved one.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. And, you know, the thing with it, this is not totally related, but the thing with it was for me, and still is that I always felt like no one ever really understood what it felt like. And how could they, if you haven't been in the pretty much exact same situation, you know? And I know, listen, restaurants are tough, period. Restaurants in New York, 50 times that toughness. So I have to like try to remind myself of that. But at the same time, if you haven't had that experience, and I know a lot of people who have closed restaurants, you know, where even, you know, when I think of them, I'm like, oh man, that must be tough. But I don't know what really it was for them. I just know my experience. And my experience was like, I'm not good enough to have a restaurant, you know, and luckily I had another one kind of going like right, you know, near the end of that. So I could still, you know, keep going. I wasn't like complete misery, but, you know, I wasn't good enough. Like there were so many things I felt like I could have done and I didn't do them. And why didn't I do them? And still to this day, I think back on it and I say, oh man, And I also look back and say, thank God that did happen, because I wouldn't have been able to do X, Y, and Z if it had still – it would still be open. And I wouldn't have learned X, Y, and Z from it if it hadn't happened. So how I deal with it, to go back to your question, is I just try to put the next kind of peg into the – climbing wall or whatever, by doing something else that will soon overshadow that. So it will never go away. It's not like it will never have not happened. It's very much there and very much present in my mind depending on the day. And this is, you know, years ago now.
Yeah.
I know that if I work hard enough in other areas, it slowly becomes less and less important and less and less in the forefront of my mind.
Did it take time for you following that? I mean, to summon the confidence again to then try something new?
Yeah, of course. I mean, listen, it's like you think that everyone it's like you're being caught with your pants down. Like yeah. everyone is standing there watching you fail, when in reality, like, no one really even saw it, or they just weren't as aware of it as I thought, like anything. You know what I mean? Anything we do, people don't actually care as much. You know, if you wear the same outfit 3 days in a row, you think that everyone notices. And I think whatever the ratio is, one out of 20 people actually even would. But anyways.
Have you ever seen those charts that say, like, you know, they're talking about geniuses and really highly accomplished people who have failed? And on this, like, chart, it's like, you know, Michael Jordan and how he got cut from his high school basketball team, and what is it, like, Thomas Edison and the thousands of prototypes for the light bulb that didn't work, and Oprah and Steve Jobs, how he was ousted from his own company. And whenever I see all these faces and narratives behind these really, really, really influential people, I know it's supposed to be encouraging to me to say, hey, it's okay to fail. But whenever I see those, that's not typically how I feel. I kind of go, well, yeah, they can fail. They can fail because they're good enough to have, I mean, to use a term we used before, a margin for error. Like, they're that dynamic, they're that talented that they can blow it and still everyone will recognize the genius within. For me, so much of what is maddening about failure, and I have a, you know, I have a whole shed full of failure. But for me, it's the thought that everything is always my one chance. And that's how it feels. So it always feels like the consequences are so much greater. Now, granted, that's cheating because I can look back at Michael Jordan's failure and go, yeah, and you would become the greatest basketball player of all time. And I know Steve Jobs is Steve Jobs. But I look at some of my failures, and when I consider failure, I still feel it to be inhibiting at times, or to almost shrink something I want to try, because I feel like everything is my only shot. And to your point, I mean, you're right. It's like those things linger with us exponentially longer than everyone else. But that doesn't change the fact what I'm actually trying to do in my life, and I don't do this very well yet, but maybe it's a little bit cliche, but allow those things to feed me a little bit. Like Philip Roth, you know, he's a novelist, and he said that, you know, he's talking about writers, but he says, you know, writers, artists, any creative person, anyone who wants to really achieve anything, they need to be a little bit insane. And he has this really cogent, compact line, and he said, writers need their poisons. And part of, for me, what that means is I take my failures as poisons. And while they hurt a little bit to reflect on, they simultaneously drive me forward, because I don't want to feel that way again.
Right.
I don't want to feel that way again. I mean, you hear about athletic teams who, you know, fall short of their goal. It's like they work to remember the feeling of that failure, not so that they would, you know, tumble into despair or to somehow be like, you know, masochistic, but it's a way to move them to the point where they wouldn't experience it again. And I try to do that in my life. Have I ever told you what happened after I first became a writer, the second job I had to take? So I, like, you know, I had this big ambition that I was going to be this author, and it was great. Or it was going to be great, right? And so I quit my job. This was back in 2007, so rolling up on 10 years. And right after I quit my job, and about a month after
Wait, hold on a second. What were you doing?
I was a pastor.
Okay. Until when?
Until 2007.
You quit your job and said, I'm going to be a writer.
And I said, I'm an artist. I'm going to be a writer. And so I quit my job. And 4 weeks after I quit my job, my dad dies. And he had been sick for a long time, Remy, really since my childhood. And I've talked a little bit about that here on this show about his addictions. So he dies a few weeks after. And I'm trying to get back on the riding horse and kind of circumvent some of this grief that's going on. And about 10 weeks after he dies, my mom dies very suddenly. And we would later find out she had cancer and we didn't know. And so now I'm internally, a total disaster. And so any sort of creative venture is really difficult. I mean, even getting out of bed was difficult. I mean, you know, I spent weeks, you know, under the sheets and coping in all the ways you would be instructed by a therapist to not cope. And I remember thinking to myself, but writing is going to, like, save me. Like, I'm going to have a moment. I mean, I'm going to get, like a call from a publisher. I'm going to get my break. And it didn't – it was no longer just, like, a writing dream. It's like it becomes, like, this – for me, it became this thing I was counting on to kind of hold me together in a time when everything was coming apart, you know. But I can't make ends meet. And I'm just getting rejected. And, you know, my wonderful wife, who was supportive of the whole thing, but also could look back in those years at the family budget and go, we're not going to make it. You need to take something else, you know. In the acting world, it was, I need to bust some tables, you know. So I get this job teaching sex education. And we were living in Austin, Texas at the time, in Austin public high schools.
But, okay, hold on a second. Let me just stop you for 1 second. Where does a job like that get publicized?
Yeah, you got to
know someone.
Well, there's all sorts of theaters and magazines. No, I actually had a friend that worked for them. Or you just got to roll in circles with sex ed teachers. And funny enough,
you knew a lot of sex ed teachers.
I knew a lot of sex ed teachers. In fact, two of my friends worked for this organization. And so I was like, knowing that I needed a job, knowing that I wanted it to be something that I wasn't going to be committing too much mental capacity to by the time I clocked out, I was like, that sounds great. And it, you know, there was like, it's one of those bizarre experiences for me that was simultaneously like hilarious and utterly heartbreaking.
Yeah, right.
You know, because it's like the things people would ask, like in the classroom, like you're talking, you're trying to legitimately have an honest and transparent conversation with a group of high school students about sex and STDs and all this stuff. And so you have to really open up the dialogue. And so the questions people would ask
that you had to field were just,
oh, man,
amazing.
And once you open the box, it's like you can't go, well, you can't ask that question,
right,
or you shut the whole thing down.
Right.
And so people would just ask the funniest things. But then you'd have, you know, concurrently these really heartbreaking moments where someone would come up to you and say, hey, I just found out I have this STD or whatever, what do I do? And then you're having like this really real moment. But the bigger point is that, you know, I quit my job thinking and, you know, really contemplating the success of it all and what it was going to look like. And it was for me and in my ego and in my vanity, and I can be so vain. It was so humiliating when people would say, hey, how's writing going? And then you're going, I'm teaching sex education because it's not working. Like I hated that. And
the worst.
Well, and then it's so funny because then this thing that you're so excited about, you don't want to talk about at all. Like then this thing that you kind of, I don't know, not in a negative way, but were so enticed by and so drawn to and felt so like was enmeshed in who you are and the way you want to spend your life, all of a sudden it's like, you don't want to utter a word of it to anybody because you just feel like every time the conversation comes up, in their head is what's in yours, or at least in their head what's in mine. And in my head was, you're a failure. And I hated it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, even just the building of this thing even like a few months ago, the only thing that people really knew is they were like, so how's the podcast?
Yeah,
and like they've never listened to a podcast.
Yeah, right.
They don't know what it is, but the way they say it just sounds like just super like, what's the word? Come on.
Demeaning?
Help me.
Condescending.
Condescending.
Okay.
Like just always, or that's how I heard it.
Yeah, right.
so what's this? You're doing a you're mm-hmm. you're not doing this massive restaurant that you've worked so hard to build and create and keep going, and you're just what is it a podcast? And I was just like, no.
Yeah, right. Backtrack.
It's more than a podcast. You know what I mean? Like, you have no idea.
Yeah.
So, no, I think, yeah, there were moments where I'd be like, oh, yeah, no, I mean, that's just not, that's nothing really. Mm. And but look over there. You know,
yeah,
yes,
right.
The restaurant is doing well. Let's stick on that.
Yep.
So that I don't have to admit to you that I feel like it's a failure right now because it just hasn't gotten big enough to really.
Yeah.
Impress you.
Yeah, right, right.
And the same way with the restaurant closing for a year, 2 years after it closed, people would say, hey, so how's, what's the place called? How's Willow Road, you know? And I'd say, oh, yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's doing really well. Because if you don't know that it's closed, I'm not going into that conversation with you right now because just – it's not worth it to me. So for how many conversations that I had to say, oh, yeah, it's going really well. And even at the end, you know, when it was – when I knew it was going to close, I'd say, oh, yeah, it's going really well.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't want people to even be able to have me in a hold in that way that I felt like they did.
The further I get into – writing, and I've been so fortunate, like, you know, I mean extraordinarily fortunate through factors way beyond my own control, but the farther I get into it, the more I realize that writing, and I think this, I don't know, I could only speak to my craft, but writing is such a test not only of craft but of character. I mean, it is like, I mean, when you're talking about writing, you know, a 75,000 page book or a 100,000 page novel or whatever it is, at some point, for me, the question becomes not do I have the ability and skill, but do I have the endurance and do I have like the stick-to-itiveness even when in a given day or a given week or a given month, every day I show up at that laptop, I fail. And do I have what it takes? Like, will I stand up again? Like, do I have that thing driving me? Again, Philip Roth, do I have that poison in me that'll get me going today and get me to show up or to become the person I need to be in order to finish this project? And sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. I got another question for you, Will. Who's had the greatest impact on your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could go a few different directions here. There's like certain key people in my life over the years that have, you know, played pretty instrumental roles. You know, I think that my father has, you know, been very important, and my mother as well. But my father, as far as from a business perspective, and as far as a support perspective, I think there's never been anything that my parents didn't support. Besides, obviously, you know, coming home drunk when I was 16 or smoking cigarettes at, you know, 14. But outside of that, I mean, they've always just got on board with what I was excited about and got excited about it. And then, like I said, my dad, from a business perspective, I hear of, you know, parents that are kind of like, well, just figure it out, you know, and I think that my dad's been really important, allowing me to mess up and make mistakes, and then, you know, guiding me when I needed guidance. But I mean, besides them, I think, you know.
What about in a distant way, like a creative or a film director or an artist, a musician, a painter, something like that?
You know, when I start in on a new project, which is something that I love to do, you know, start a new project, I always become very just full on, fully encompassed into that project. And I get blinders, basically. Hmm. And so what comes to mind right now is not a musician or a painter or a, you know, or an author, because that's just not what I'm fully immersed in right now. So at this moment, the person that kind of comes to mind is a person who I've you know, been able to meet, and actually I was able to have him on my podcast called The Drop-In. You should listen to it. But no, besides that, I was able to have him on, and because I tracked him down and was so kind of enamored by his vision and his persistence. And that's one thing that I feel like I have a little bit of both of those things, but that I'm always striving to have more of. And this person, you know, a lot of people don't even know who he is. His name is Chris Hardwick, which is the reason I kind of started this. I was able to model kind of At Will Radio after what he had created with something called Nerdist Industries. And he had the foresight and the vision to kind of see that podcasting in this new form of media was the next kind of big thing, and had the persistence to kind of grow this company organically and fast. And for me, he's been in this moment in my life very important, and, you know, someone that I kind of aspire, not as in like, you know, I want to be doing exactly what he's doing in his life and how he did it, but the fact that he was able to put a stake down in the ground and create something big out of something small, that resonates for me, because that's what I'm trying to do, and that's what I've always kind of tried to do, is create something that a lot of people are going to know about from, you know, a kernel.
Yeah. Well, and for you to do that for a lot of people, but to, in the midst of that, retain that desire and that heart for it to be meaningful to the people that encounter it, I think is part of what makes you so unique, is it's not like, let's just make it big just for the sake of bigness. It's like, let's make it big so that a lot of people can drink from something that's really, really meaningful to a lot of people. Dude, thanks so much for coming on. I'll probably pester you to return at some point.
Next week, the return of Will. People are like, I already heard everything I wanted to know.
Or following my just stellar 5-star reviewed impression of you, I could just go back and forth and maybe nobody would know the difference.
Yeah, exactly. That would be funny. I'd love to see you try that.
Thanks for coming on, Will.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks so much for listening to The Marrow. To find me on social media for upcoming live appearances or to buy a book, you can visit joshreebach.com. But please join me again next week.